Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. If you're looking to give or receive a good read this holiday season, you might consider Alexander Watson's River Queens. It's a surprising, quirky, and compelling story of a multi-year journey by Watson and his partner Dale Harris to acquire, renovate, and then pilot a vintage wooden motor yacht along some of America's southern rivers, starting in Texas and ultimately ending in Cincinnati. Alexander Watson joins me today to talk about the book. Alexander, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So it's a pleasure to have you. Let's just set the context very, very briefly here. Give our listeners just a thumbnail sketch of your life leading up to the decision to buy this boat and then a few years later to take this trip. Just, you know, again, just to give us the context.
My partner Dale Harris and I were not boaters. In fact, we were landlords. And at the end of a rather disappointing movie, our sense of escape had not been sated. And so I suggested to Dale that we go to the Dallas Boat Show in 2001, not for any interest, but we had never done that. And so it was like, let's go. Let's go see what this is about. So we got in the truck and we went to Dallas's Market Hall and walked into the boat show, where all we saw were great big white boats without propellers and with lists of specifications we had no idea how to make heads or tails of, and the prices were astronomical. We weren't boaters. And I am usually the one that disappears when Dale and I are together. I find something that distracts me and I walk off, forgetting to turn to Dale and say, I'm going to be over here. In this particular case, Dale was the one that said that had disappeared, and he had gone to a for sale board just to cruise it over. And he called to me across the hall, which he never does. And so I was like putting on my jacket, getting ready to go. And he said, come here, you have to look at this. And I went behind a great big plastic fiberglass mega yacht, and there was a for sale board with a bunch of sparkly white boats on clear blue waters. And down in the corner was a perforated picture, perforated by all the pinpricks of all the shows that this image had been posted to, of something that looked vaguely like oatmeal. And if you looked carefully at this image, you could make out a bow. And if you kept looking, you could make out a stern. And finally, what came to light was the image of a boat the likes of which I had never seen before. And I said to Dale rather casually, we should go look at that, just as a curiosity. A few weeks later, we had opportunity. We had business outside of the city of Dallas, and we had opportunity to go look at this boat. And it was a clear February day, like Texas winters are, but quickly turned bad. And we tried to beg off our appointment to go see this boat, because we're not boaters. And the guy at the marina said, no, 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 come on, you're on your way, come on. And we arrived at 5 o'clock, the sun's going down, the ice is coming down, and we go, and Dale and I admit 3 years later to a third party that when we saw the prow of this boat, our hearts jumped in our chest, having no idea what we were fixing to take on, having no idea what it was going to take to have a wooden boat. And so we acquired a wooden boat and spent 2 years doing the restoration. Fast forward to 2007, we had an opportunity at the height of the housing bubble to sell all of our acquisitions, to just liquidate the portfolio and go wherever we wanted. And I said to Dale, I'd like to take a river trip in our boat. And he was resistant at first, but he then said, okay, we can go if we can live in a northern state. Dale is a Wisconsinite, dragged to Texas against his will at 16 years old when his father was looking for work. And he never quite acclimated to the Texas heat and the southern way of doing things. And so he said, all right, if we move to a northern state. And so Dale and I decided to embark on this trip, which we thought was going to be a summertime junket, like from Memorial Day to Labor Day. Turned out to be 15 months. And I caught him at Louisville, Kentucky, eyeing the skyline. You know, the way you eye things that you think you really want, but you really know you shouldn't have. And I said from behind, I said, no, no, no. Louisville is not in the Kentucky, not in a southern state. Kentucky is not a southern state. And so we pushed on to Cincinnati, and we've lived here 10 years.
So just tell me a little bit more, though, about the boat itself that you bought. These are pretty unusual now. I mean, that's one of the things that comes out later in the book. But the boat itself is pretty unusual, right?
It's a 1955 Chris Craft Corsair, which is a cruiser. It's 45 feet long. It had twin diesel Hercules engines in it when it was built in 1955. Somewhere along the way, those engines were taken out, and scrap engines were put in, just whatever was sitting around the yard, which turned out to be a pair of Crusader, that's Chevrolet, Crusader copycats. They're not even the real thing. They're still in the boat. They got us up the river. We've since had them rebuilt, but they're in the boat. They're gasoline. And it's it is one of 60 that were ever produced. And so it is a rarity that they are extant. I know of two in Puget Sound, one in the greater Los Angeles area, and I know that there is one rotting in dry dock in West Virginia, and then there is ours.
Well, just the story of just getting the boat ready to be able to put in the water and drive it, that was an ordeal in and of itself. I'll tell you, I've got a 14-foot aluminum fishing boat. It's got a 15-horsepower outboard motor. You have put me off the idea of getting a bigger boat forever, I think. But congratulations to you for getting it ready. How were you able to learn all the things that the two of you had to learn in order to make this thing waterworthy and then in order to pilot it? How'd you do that?
Failure and error. We did a lot of things wrong, and we did them wrong repeatedly. And if you do something wrong enough times, you finally learn the correct way to do it. That said, before we bought the boat, divine intervention steered us to Nigel Calder's treatise on boat maintenance. And we studied it, pored over it, cover to cover. And that was our primer for doing this. And then, because we had no idea of what we were doing, we had to engage and recruit help wherever we could find it. And in Texas, the sun eats wooden boats. The sun eats boats in Texas, but wooden boats in particular. And so there was not a lot of expertise to draw upon. However, divine intervention again, Clay Burns was the boatwright at Highport Marina in Pottsboro, Texas, where we bought the boat. And Clay was retiring the same year that we bought the boat, 2001. And he said, guys, I am going to retire, and I've been working on this boat. I've been working on boats since the Korean War, and I have been working on this boat for 20 years. And so let me show you what I know before I go up to Colorado in my fifth wheel with my wife where there are no boats, and that's where I'll die. And so we spent a month side by side with Clay Burns learning how to be boatwrights. Subsequently, when we got to Sallisaw, Oklahoma, where we were putting the boat in the river, we were at the mercy of amateur drag racers from the drag strip next door, as well as anybody could refer us to. What we found when we got in Cincinnati, though, was that Cincinnati is a wooden boat haven, and that wooden boats here in Michigan and in Michigan are fairly prevalent. So we kind of just lucked into an atmosphere where wooden boats are they're not easy to come by, but they are not the anomaly they were in Texas.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Alexander Watson, author of the book River Queens. So in your book, I want to get into some of the substance now of the more reflective things that you write about. But in your book, The River, and I mean that as abstract from any one river, I guess river with a capital R maybe, it seems to emerge from your book as its own place, you know, with its own character. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, sir. The river is its own character. I'm so glad you brought that up. Nobody's ever mentioned that to me before. The river is a character in that it is an environment. it is an environment that is not accessible by road or plane or rail. It's an environment that's only accessible by boat, which sounds obvious and trite when I say it. But when one lives and works in a hostile environment, and water is a hostile environment to anybody who doesn't have gills, then the premise, the overriding premise of that environment is the safety of all. And in fact, the Good Samaritan law, which says that on the road you're responsible for any aid you provide, on the water it's mandated. You have to stop. You have to render aid. Mm-hmm. And so when your whole mindset is rendering aid to the safety and well-being of all, then it creates an entirely different environment, a social, it creates an entire different social dynamic for two reasons. First of all, life on the river is very close quarters, and so you have to be very respectful of each other's space. But also, people on the river are there to have fun. And so there are very limited engagements or opportunities to be unattractive, because you never know who the person you're fixing to be rude to is going to be your rescuer in the next 5 seconds.
So,
as my grandmother used to say, you have to be nice.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Alexander Watson, author of the book River Queens, which we've been discussing. So, Alexander, I want to continue on with this discussion we had before the break about the river and its nature and what it does. And you were explaining some of the reasons why the dynamic that you experience might be unpleasant. I want to sort of push that a little further. When I was reading, it seems like there was in your book, there's this relationship between the place of the river and then the other identities that we individuals have, whether they're class or region, sexual orientation, ethnic identities, the things that we carry with us and we have as individuals, which in our country can divide us, which we're seeing quite a bit of lately. But on the river, it seemed like those divisions are still there, but they can be overcome. There's a connection that comes through the river, and you described that, and you talked about the Good Samaritan law regarding that. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about that, about how you connect with people that it sounds like in another realm, each of you would have prejudged the other and perhaps gone your separate ways.
Certainly. You are a boater. Is that not true?
I am a very limited boater, not anything like what you have.
Okay. But you understand
I can drive
that
a boat.
But you understand that a boat takes a certain discipline and a certain mindset and a certain love for what one is doing in order to maintain that boat and to keep that boat operational and that boat safe. You understand that?
That's right. Easier proposition for me than for what you have, but yes.
Regardless, what you and I have in common as boaters is the discipline and the drive and the ambition and the initiative and the imagination to keep and operate a boat. And so right there, we have that first thing in common. And the second thing is that the river speaks to us. The river doesn't speak to everybody. I had guests on the water the other day, and it was one of those wonderful late summer nights where the sun was oblique, setting oblique, and there was this fresh wind coming off from the northwest, and there was a little chop on the water, and it was one of those magical, magical nights on the river that rare. Mm. It's what we work for all season, right? Mm. And I stood up on the bridge to feel it, to communicate with it, to absorb it, to memorize it, and my guests, who are landlubbers, had no idea what I was doing. If you had been there, you and I would have put our hands around each other's shoulders and just sucked it in like air. So that's the second thing that we have in common, all right? The third thing is that we have a wanderlust. No one with a boat does not have wanderlust. How many negatives were in that sentence? Anyway, so there is yet another thing we have in common. strictly by virtue of the fact that we are both boaters. So when you're on the river, you're going to run into people who you automatically have those things in common without uttering a word. That said, had Dale and I not been in a 1955 fully restored Chris-Craft Corsair cruiser with stateroom, galley, salon amidships, we would not have the same reception, I don't think. We also had, to our advantage, a spotted Dalmatian dog named Doris Fay. And Doris Fay had to pee with some regularity. So the first thing that happened once we landed was one of us would go walk the dog. And she was very solicitous, and so she would introduce us to everyone. So other than beyond the things that you and I have just talked about that boaters naturally have in common, what Betty Jane, our boat, what Betty Jane said about us as we approached the dock was, these guys know how to take care of a wooden boat, a vintage wooden boat, a 45-foot wooden boat, and they have a good-looking dog.
Dog always helps.
So on the river, if you've got a good-looking rig and a good-looking dog, that covers a multitude of variation deviancies that wouldn't necessarily happen on land.
Right. Well, so in that regard, continuing on this theme, it may be in part because of the dog and the boat, but the stories of your encounters that you tell in the book, they have what struck me as a redemptive quality to them, and that both the other folks and you are redeemed ultimately by this innate humanity, which is coming out. And again, I thought the river helped with that. I want to, if I can, just read a brief excerpt from your book, which I think speaks to that. And then I have a question that comes out of it. Here's the excerpt. "It was a trip taken in the prime of our lives when we could truly enjoy the challenge, when we could afford to live nowhere in particular, and when we were prepared to toss off the familiar in exchange for the adventure. As a result, we got to see our country and our countrymen as they are rarely seen. The America we saw was not the angst, anger, and fear we see on broadcast and social media. It was the America that explored the New World and settled the West and gathered its great diversity into one united force whenever the homeland was threatened. It was the America from which we hope to never fully return." That's a wonderful passage. I'm sorry I tripped over it in part. So I'm a political scientist by trade, and I deal a lot with conflict, political conflict. So I've got to ask you this question. I'm still left wondering whether there weren't interactions on the river where there was no redemption, where that you've left out, you chose not to tell in your book. Were there experiences that weren't so nice?
There was an encounter at Spadra that is in the book about a woman whose at-home spa day we interrupted, and she was ingracious about that. There is an episode in Golconda, Illinois, where I encountered a woman selling peppers of all description that was not indicative of what was on the river. But those are both landlubber. Oh, and there's a third in Madison, Indiana, where I make a point to describe what happens when you get 500 feet off the river. The landlubbing society that we know takes over. And what's curious about this phenomenon is, Grant, is that the charts that we used on the river, because GPS was unreliable, we actually used paper charts. The charts only detail the shoreline, including and up to 500 feet. Beyond that, it's blank, right? And that's so that the boater can identify landmarks as he or she is going up or down the river. What I found coincidental was that is also where the river culture stops. And the land-loving culture takes over, is about 500 feet. So when you get off the boat and you walk about 500 feet into town, the further you get away from the river, the more you're leaving the river behind. So to answer your question, the redemptive part had to do with the fact that for a lot of the people we encountered, we were the first one, if not two, homosexual men they had ever encountered, that they'd ever met. They had never met. Homosexuality was a thing that existed in the faraway reaches of the urban jungle. And by virtue of the fact that we were always in need of fresh water, fuel, groceries, meds, just rest, food, whatever, we're always in need because we're sustaining life on this boat. It's a big boat, granted, but it can't. We had on board a 2-cubic-foot refrigerator and a 2-plate hot plate as our galley, and so we are always asking people, where are we stopped, for help. And by virtue of the fact that we presented ourselves as vulnerable, I believe brought out the charity in them. And by virtue of the fact that the two of us had to interact and had to engage one another, we discovered things about each other that we certainly did not know.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Alexander Watson, author of River Queens. So you're not always so easy with yourself in this book. I don't intend any offense here, but from your own descriptions, you don't always come off so good. You're pretty tough with yourself in this book at various points. So I was curious to know, in what respects do you think you changed as a person as a result of this experience?
I had to learn to be patient. I had to learn to be tolerant. I had to learn that if I were not to be judged, I was not allowed to judge. And I was very careful in the narrative to be as candid about myself as I am in the book, because that then gives me license to be candid about the other people in the book. I can't very well throw the first stone if I'm not willing to aim it at myself. I can't very well say these are the faults of the other guy if I'm not willing to reveal to the reader I have them too. So I felt that I had a duty, in order to be candid and honest about the entire adventure, I felt an obligation to be candid and honest about me, too.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you, there are so many interesting people in this book. That's one of the many things I would say to recommend it to others. But is there any one person that you met that has stayed with you in your head more than any of the others?
John Bartlett. John Bartlett was as far away from anything I had ever met in my entire life. And I was raised by wolves. So this is one of the attractions Dale and I have for each other. I was raised by wolves, and he was raised by teetotaling Seventh-day Baptists. And so the diversity and dichotomy in our own domestic relationship is what's attractive to us. And so I had been exposed to a lot of different kinds of people with my parents' artistic endeavors. But John Bartlett was a Cajun with web feet, web hands, probably ate nutria, held his hand cleaved to a fishing pole, and I fell in love with him emotionally and sexually the moment I saw him. And he proved to be one of the most important guides and mentors we had on the river. Not that he was with us the entire time. In fact, we left him in Salisaw. But his advice and his words and his directions and his attitude, John's attitude about the river was, he had a Gibson houseboat, and his attitude was out on two, back on one, meaning he would go out with two running engines, and he always came back with a failure somewhere along the way. And when you have that attitude implanted in your mind by a river rat, a true river rat, not a wannabe like we were. When you have that attitude implanted in your mind, then nothing on the river really is going to overwhelm you, because your expectation is out on two, back on one.
That's interesting. We've only got about a minute or so left, but I wanted to squeeze this last question in. So you take this trip, you end up in Cincinnati. I guess you qualify Ohio as a northern state. You're in the southern part of a northern state. The boat is still with you now, though. What's in just about a minute? Tell us what's going on with that boat now.
Our boat is in the water for the winter. It's six of one and a half dozen the other. Pulling the boat out for the winter, she's up on blocks, and therefore her frame twists and yaws with the pressure of not being supported by the water. And so when we put her back in, she wants to sink instantly. And launching is one of the most stressful things I have to deal with in my modern life. Though I've never had a colicky baby in the middle of the night, I understand that's even worse. So this year we keep her in the water, and she's undercover, and she will suffer varnish damage because of the ice and the snow. On the other hand, her bottom stays wet, and so she won't sink, we hope, touch wood. But she still gives us a great deal of joy. Dale and I don't have any big adventures planned because we've had our big adventure. But the boat is a member of our family just as much as our new dog Cole is, and each other. So we will rue the day when we get too old that we can't take care of her.
Well, that was Alexander Watson, and his book, again, is River Queens. Alexander, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me, and also thanks for writing that book. I want to tell you that it's going to stay with me for a long time, so I really appreciate that.
I thank you for the opportunity to speak to your audience.
We're happy to give it to you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.